Good day. Today is Monday, 16th March 2026. And before I proceed with this program, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this program or whichever part of this program you want to watch or listen to, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate this fact. Well, today I believe I am right in saying that we are entering into the 17th day of the conflict between the United States and Israel and Iran. I read a rather disturbing, or at least for me disturbing, article in the Financial Times earlier today, saying that in Israel at least, which is of course one of the dueling parties in this war, all of the various political leaders are competing with each other to take the hardest possible line against Iran, that the rhetoric is all about waging the war to the finish, and that to the extent that there is any criticism of Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel itself, the criticism is that he hasn't gone hard enough or fast enough, and his political opponents are all saying that they could do it better. So there is no sign that in Israel, at least, there is any weakening of resolve. There is no sign that there is any weakening of resolve on the part of the Iranian leadership either. The Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, has now come out and said categorically that Iran is not interested in a ceasefire, is not looking for a ceasefire, that it wants a victory which will result in a permanent peace that will end once and forever the possibility of further attacks upon Iran. That obviously puts the bar very high, but that is what Foreign Minister Araghchi is saying. And the president of Iran, Masoud Pezeshkian, has had a telephone conversation with that individual who constantly tries to insert himself into every crisis, even though he has nothing interesting or valuable to say about it. And of course, I am referring now to President Macron of France. Anyway, Macron telephoned Pezeshkian, said to him that it's quite improper, entirely wrong, for Iran to obstruct freedom of navigation in the Strait of Hormuz. Macron basically telling Pezeshkian that Iran should reverse its policy here. And from the Iranian readout, it looks as if Pezeshkian gave Macron short shrift, as, by the way, and as we will discuss shortly, others, notably the Russians, are doing currently as well. So, for the moment at least, it looks as if two of the key parties, Iran and Israel, the resolve there remains as strong as always. And here I'm going to reference a video that my good friend Brian Beletic has done on the new Atlas, in which Brian Beletic talks about the conflict that took place previously between the United States and Iraq. And he pointed out that the siege of Iraq was a very protracted affair. There was the first Gulf War of 1990-1991, and the heavy bombing and the ground war that took place over the course of it. Then there was the relentless sanctions siege that followed it. Then there were periodic bombing campaigns that took place against Iran, notably Operation Desert Fox in 1998. And then as Iraq gradually became increasingly weakened and isolated, the eventual ground invasion which toppled Saddam Hussein's government and achieved regime change in Iran, in Iraq, followed in 2003. So this is a 12-year conflict. And Brian Beletic points out that if events were to be allowed to take that course and the United States were to wage and go on waging the current conflict against Iran, but were to decide to stop and were allowed to stop, then there is every reason to think that at some point in the future, possibly the quite near future, a further attack would come, and there would be more and more attacks as Iran gradually became suffocated in exactly the same way that Iraq once was. Well, the Iranian leadership are acutely aware of this risk. I remember some weeks ago, before the conflict started, reading an article by Alistair Crook, who of course he knows Iran well, and he said that this was an eventuality that the Iranians want to avoid at all costs. And then, sure enough, shortly after, there was a further article which appeared in the Financial Times, making exactly the same point, that the Iranians had come to a conclusion that accepting the kind of conflict in which American attacks come and go, a conflict in which the United States increases relentlessly the sanctions pressure, and in which the United States continuously looks for and finds internal supporters or collaborators inside Iran in order to continue the efforts to destabilize the political system of that country. The Iranian leadership are very, very well aware that if they let themselves be drawn into that kind of campaign of endless pressure upon themselves, they could find themselves in the end in a similar position to the one that Saddam Hussein's government found itself in 2003. And for that reason, they're not prepared to do that. They understand that the only way forward is to extend the current war, reject all proposals for ceasefires, continue the pressure on the United States and on the US's Arab and Israeli allies, force the United States eventually into agreeing to some long-term permanent solution, one which will safeguard Iran from future attack. And that ultimately explains the strategy that Iran is currently following. Now, before I proceed, I would add one other major difference between Iraq in the 1990s and Iran at present, which is that, of course, Iraq in the 1990s was isolated. The series of steps that Saddam Hussein took, basically after 1980, when he launched his own war against Iran, had eventually come to exasperate and alienate him from all of his previous allies, the Arab states, the Russians, and eventually, by the 1990s, a period which was also, of course, a time of unchallenged US global dominance. It was the high noon of the unipolar moment. Well, given that this was so, Saddam Hussein and his government, and indeed Iraq, were left facing all of these relentless pressures that were brought to bear upon them by the United States, by themselves. By contrast, Iran, a very much bigger country than Iraq, with a much larger population, has friends. It has its friends in Russia. It has its friends in China. It is a member of the BRICS. As I repeatedly say, I don't think so far it has taken full advantage of all of the opportunities that BRICS membership bring with it. It even managed back in 2003 to patch up relations, 2023, to patch up relations with the Gulf Arab states, which had previously been solidly hostile. And it also even managed, using Chinese mediation, to improve relations with Saudi Arabia. And though those relations between Iran and the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia are now under very great stress, they have not so far completely broken down. And as well as the Chinese and the Russians and BRICS altogether, Iran also has friendly relations with Pakistan and at least civil relations with Turkey. So Iran is in a very much stronger position to withstand a siege than Iraq was in the 1990s. But nonetheless, it's completely understandable, given the previous history, that Iran does not want to be subjected to that kind of indefinite siege, and is for precisely that reason drawing out the current war in the hope that this can lead to a full and complete settlement of the conflict between itself and the United States, thereby safeguarding Iran from future attack from the United States. And coming back to my discussion in my program yesterday of the article by Kautilya, the Contemplator, I think that this is what explains the Iranian demand for the United States to dismantle its bases, at least in the Gulf region. It's a demand that follows logically from Iran's wish at the present time to seek a permanent end to this constant threat of attack upon itself. Now, I have discussed in several programs why I cannot imagine that the United States would willingly agree, or would agree at all, to dismantle all its bases across the Middle East. I've also said that Iran, if it wants future guarantees that the pressure upon it would go, well, I think it should seriously explore alternative options. One would be to follow the North Korean option, as argued persuasively in an article on his Substack site by the French commentator Arnaud Bertrand. That would, of course, mean going nuclear. That is a course which I would not personally at all want to see happen, but which would make a kind of logical sense for Iran. The alternative one, which I personally would advocate, is that Iran develop further its relations with the BRICS states, accept security guarantees from them, start accepting supplies of weapons, advanced weapons from them, place itself with their help in a position where an attack upon it is no longer militarily viable, and integrate its economy with the BRICS economies in a way that would provide Iran with a long-term future which is not affected by American sanctions. Anyway, my key point is that we are in this situation. The Iranians, full resolve to see this thing through, and we can understand the reason why. The Israelis also, complete resolve to see this through as well. The United States is a different story. Here we have, at least outwardly, a continued appearance of confusion. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, gave a short interview to the Financial Times yesterday. He was extremely critical of the US's NATO allies. He basically said that it was their business to try to unblock the Strait of Hormuz. He's made further comments to that effect since. He said that since the United States is self-sufficient in energy, it is not affected directly by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. By the way, another point that Brian Beletic made in his video. And the President of the United States says that it is those countries that are most affected by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz who should take responsibility to open it. Now, this follows reports, which I saw in the New York Times, of an argument, another contentious meeting between President Trump and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane. Now, allegedly, and I fully expect, by the way, the president at some point over the next few hours to deny the truth of this story, as he has up to now denied all claims of differences between himself and General Kane. Anyway, according to this story in the New York Times, which I generally believe, the president is becoming increasingly frustrated and increasingly angry with the US military because they are not taking any steps so far to unblock the Strait of Hormuz. And these calls that he is making to the US's allies to unblock the Straits of Hormuz, the Europeans first and foremost, but incredibly also China as well. The reason the president is saying all of this is because he does actually, for his own political survival, need energy flows to resume properly, and wants the Strait of Hormuz unblocked, but he is facing resistance from the US military to doing it. So he says the British, the French, the Germans, the Chinese, the Italians, all of these people who need the energy from the Gulf, they should be doing it instead. This is their responsibility and their task. And to anticipate all of these countries that have been pressed to do this, Britain, France, Australia, there's been no word about this from China. I can't imagine that they take this proposal seriously there. Just saying. Anyway, they've all said no. They've all said, all of these countries have said no. The German Defence Minister, Boris Pistorius, a hawk, a strong supporter of Ukraine during the conflict there. Anyway, he's come out and said what is obviously true. If the mighty US Navy cannot unblock the Strait of Hormuz, then it is absurd to think that the far less powerful navies of the US's various allies can do it instead. So there it is. The president is not taking this well. He's now saying that the failure of the Western allies, especially to support the United States in unblocking the Strait of Hormuz, calls the future of NATO into question. That, of course, is a very unpopular statement in Europe as well. And the president of the United States, interestingly, is now floating the possibility, very much as we on the Duran anticipated, that he might postpone his trip to China. There was a meeting between Scott Bessent and Vice President Lin of China, Vice Prime Minister Lin of China, in which they discussed steps towards arranging President Trump's forthcoming visit to China, the one that's due to take place on the 31st of March. I've always myself felt that the President Donald Trump would be reluctant to travel to China if the conflict with Iran was still underway. Anyway, unsurprisingly, at least unsurprisingly to me, he's now talking about postponing it. And the president also, when asked about possible Russian support for Iran, said the only realistic thing that he has said, in my opinion, over the course of the last couple of days, which is that he didn't know whether it was taking place or not. He accepted the possibility that it might indeed be happening. But he also said, and said entirely properly, that given the kind of help that the United States is giving to Ukraine, it would not be surprising if Russia was providing similar help to Iran. Not only unsurprising, but perhaps predictable. And as Trump even went further to say, given the kind of military support and intelligence assistance and economic assistance that the United States has been giving to Ukraine, the United States is not really best placed to criticize any support that Russia has been giving to Iran. It was a very interesting set of statements, and it rather confirms my own belief that the intelligence that the United States has been collecting, far from ruling out the possibility that Russia is providing support from Iran, on the contrary, is coming increasingly to the conclusion that it probably is. Now, on this, once again, we are getting information. I would say not information, but perhaps more properly rumours. There are rumours flying around Moscow that Iran's new supreme leader, Mokhtada Khamenei, is actually in Russia and that he is receiving treatment in Russia for the injuries he suffered in the missile strikes that killed his father and other members of his immediate family on the 28th of February. And very interestingly, the Kremlin was asked by an Arab media outlet whether or not these reports were true, And this morning, Peskov, Putin's spokesman, did not deny them. This is the report from TASS. Russian presidential press secretary Dmitry Peskov has refused to comment on allegations that Iran's new leader, Ayatollah Muqtada Khamenei, has arrived in Moscow for medical treatment. "We never comment on such reports," he told journalists when asked about the Kuwaiti newspaper Al Jarida's publication on this matter. They claim that the Russians never comment on reports like that, by the way, is not true. I do recall other instances when the Russians have indeed confirmed that they've been providing medical help for some world leader or other. I remember the way back in the 1970s, for example, the Soviet authorities at that time confirmed that the Algerian president, President Boumedienne, was in Moscow for medical treatment. I'm sure there have been many other cases of that kind since. I've never known it to be a hard and fast rule that the Russians deny that medical treatment is being provided to any particular person at any particular time. However, we must be very careful not to treat a negative as a positive, a denial, or rather the absence of a denial, as in this case, that something is happening, as a positive proof that it is happening. Peskov did not confirm that Muqtada Khamenei is in Moscow receiving medical treatment for his injuries. But having said that, from my own point of view, it does seem to me that if there was no truth at all to this story, it would be much more likely that Peskov would simply say as much and would offer a formal denial. Now, I have been checking the Iranian media this morning. I find no reference to this story there at all. I see that they've made no comment about the reports in the Arab media about Muqtada Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, being in Moscow for medical treatment. And I've seen no reference to this comment on the part of Peskov. So here is what I think, and I want to stress again, this is what I think. We have no positive confirmation that Muqtada Khamenei is indeed in Moscow, but I think it is possible, and I put it no higher than that, that he is, and that there is an agreement between the Russians and the Iranians that if there are any questions about it, the fact should neither be admitted nor denied. That is my own best guess about this. As I said, I think it is possible, perhaps even more than possible, that Muqtada Khamenei is in Moscow receiving medical treatment there, presumably in the Kremlin clinic, but I don't know this for a fact. Anyway, further evidence, if you like, of the closeness in relations between Iran and Russia about the kind of assistance that the Russians might be providing to Iran. And perhaps, just possibly, this might also fall within the framework of the humanitarian assistance that Pezeshkian has previously thanked Putin for Russia having provided to Iran over the course of this conflict. Humanitarian, in this case, being treatment and medical help to Iran's supreme leader. Anyway, lots of uncertainties, lots of rumours still. But I'm going to suggest that there is a pattern starting to develop, which does suggest a certain degree of Russian help to Iran, perhaps even extensive Russian help to Iran. And obviously there is a policy both from Iran and from Russia not to confirm it. And clearly the United States, which must know what is really going on, is not for the moment prepared to speak about it too openly, though we've had Donald Trump's comments. And as I said, you can draw whatever conclusions you wish. Now, on this whole issue, there's also been another report from, I think it was another journal, again, maybe in the Middle East, about the topic that I discussed yesterday, the arrest of General Kani, the head of the Quds force, Iran's elite special forces and covert operations agency, the agency that was previously headed by General Soleimani, and which is part of the IRGC. And of course, I discussed yesterday that reports were appearing on the internet which suggested that General Kani had been arrested by the Iranian authorities on the 1st of March, directly after the attack that killed the previous supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and that he was arrested because of compelling evidence that he was the main person who has, for many years now, been leaking critical information to Israel and the United States, enabling the trail of assassinations that we have seen in Iran, against Hezbollah, in Lebanon, in other places take place, culminating in the assassination on the 28th of February of the supreme leader of Iran and much of Iran's top military and intelligence leadership. Well, the very latest reports appear to confirm that a third party was indeed involved in maintaining surveillance on Kani and was briefing the IRGC, or at least the counterintelligence section of the IRGC, that Kani was in contact with the Israelis and the Americans. But this report points at China rather than Russia as being the agency, the third party, whose intelligence services were keeping track on Kani and were giving this information to the Iranians. And that may very well be true. I don't know one way or the other. If it is true, then it would again suggest that it isn't just the Russians who are involved in providing support to Iran, but China as well, which, if that is indeed the case, makes the entire proposal coming from the President of the United States that China act against its own ally, Iran, by forcing open the Strait of Hormuz, deploying its navy to do it, even more far-fetched and ridiculous than it already is. Now, there is, at this point, I should say, a further aspect of this story, because it also says that Carney is dead. Previous reports were suggesting that he had been executed. This time it is suggested that he committed suicide immediately after his arrest, rather than be subjected to the kind of trial and questioning and eventual execution which would unquestionably have followed. Well, it is an interesting story. Again, I don't claim that I know the full truth, but I've seen, again, no Iranian denials of the essential outline that Carney was indeed an agent of the Israelis and or of the Americans. And I would have thought that if Carney was alive and well and still held in high regard in Iran, we would be hearing about this and we would be seeing some visible sign of him. So again, you can draw your own conclusions, but I have drawn mine. I've come round to the view that the report that I discussed yesterday, and which is apparently also based on information that has been published in Middle East Eye, a very interesting and very well-informed journal based in London of uncertain ownership and funding. Anyway, and as I said, very well-informed altogether, I've come to the conclusion that this information about Carney is almost certainly also true. Now, before I complete my wrap-up of the information about the Iran war at the present time, there's a few further things I wanted to say. Firstly, the United States continues to insist that Iran's launches of drones and missiles are reducing. Brian Beletic, in that video on the new Atlas, and various other sources that I have seen, say that this is simply not the case, that Iran launches roughly 3 drone and missile strikes each day, and that the aggregate number of missiles that Iran launches on any particular day varies between 30 and 50, but that this level of launches remains constant. By contrast, we have been getting further reports that the Israelis are now complaining to the United States that they have almost completely run out of air defense missile interceptors. There's been a report to this effect in one of those interesting journals in the United States that publish this sort of information, and which basically cater, so far as I can see, to the US military and security complex. So that there's been apparently meetings now between the Israelis and the Americans, with the Israelis complaining about the fact that they're running short of air defense missile interceptors, and that Israel entered the conflict with a reduced number of air defense missile interceptors anyway, because it had been unable to replace the air defense missile interceptors which it lost during the 12-day war in June 2025. Now, I said that Iran is launching between 30 and 50 missiles a day. it is so far launching fewer missiles towards Israel, or at least that's my sense, than was the case in June. But that is unsurprising because the geographical range of targets that Iran is launching missiles against is very much wider this time. It continues to launch drone and missile strikes against American bases and installations across the Middle East and against oil facilities now, increasingly, in the Gulf as well, and in other places. If Iran concentrated all of its missile strikes on Israel, then of course the depletion rate of Israeli air defense missile interceptors would be much greater. But that is not Iran's current strategy. Just saying. Now, another thing is that recently, fairly recently, a couple of days ago, in fact, the US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said that the United States has achieved complete aerial dominance over Iran. This means that US B-52 bombers and B-1 bombers are able to operate over Iran, dropping gravity bombs. I have been more than a little skeptical about these claims. And, well, in fact, it appears that the B-52 bombers and the B-1 bombers are, in fact, launching JASSMs, missiles, towards Iran rather than flying into Iranian airspace and dropping gravity bombs. So, for the moment at least, it looks as if both Israel and the United States are continuing to conduct their air offensive against Iran from a distance. That doesn't mean that it isn't devastating. Obviously, it is. But it doesn't look as if the United States, for the moment at least, is using gravity bombs, or at least not to the extent that Pete Hegseth sort of implies. Now, of course, using missiles like JASSMs is going to put a drain on the stockpiles of these missiles. And we continue to receive all sorts of reports that the United States is now steadily running down its inventory of missiles and precision-guided weapons altogether. And there's been a good article by Larry Johnson on Sonar 21, in which he discusses the situation with air defense missile interceptors. He speculates that the United States may have run through its stockpile of TAD missiles. The situation with Patriot missiles is not quite so bad, but the stockpile there is also reducing fast. And I saw a report this morning that Greece, which until recently has resisted pressure to supply Patriot missiles and air defense missiles generally to Ukraine for its war, that Greece has now shipped a quarter of its Patriot PAC-3 air defense missile interceptors to the UAE, which is critically running short of these missiles. The fact that the Greeks are doing this rather than the Americans, to my mind, tells its own story. All of these missile stockpiles, or so it seems to me, are becoming steadily run down. Now, in his video, Brian Beletic, who it is important to remember, is a former US Navy Marine. Anyway, he has provided what I consider to be by far the most thorough discussion of the deployment of the Marine Force, the US Marine Force, to the Persian Gulf area that was being talked about some days ago. And he's pointed out, he's confirmed, as far as I'm concerned, the point that many others, including myself, have been making, that this force, which was indeed significantly reorganized about some time ago, into essentially a light infantry force, that this force, assuming it were even deployed to capture Kharg Island, would be very severely exposed to potential Iranian bombardment on Kharg Island, which leads me to wonder whether this is indeed the plan, and that this force, which, as I said, is a light infantry force, apparently it was reorganized, the Marines were reorganized to become a light infantry force, because this was the way it was expected it would operate in a future war with China, which would involve operations in the islands, on the islands in the East China Sea. Again, I find that extraordinary thinking in itself, by the way. But anyway, the Marines have been reorganized for that kind of operation, rather than for the kind of heavy amphibious operation to seize places like Kharg Island, or to force open the Straits of Hormuz. That's not perhaps the kind of task they are specifically designed for. But there is a great deal else that they could do. And Ryan Beletic made the point that the deployment of this force does significantly supplement the US military operations against Iran. And it makes a great deal of sense in that context. There is something else that it did strike me that this force might also be capable of doing. I expressed bafflement some days ago as to why the United States continues to let Iran export oil through the Gulf of Hormuz, why it is not interfering with the tanker traffic carrying Iranian oil, mostly it seems to China, but to some extent to India as well. It's been pointed out to me by a number of people that the Indian Ocean is enormous, that it will be very difficult for the United States to keep full track of where the various tankers were at any one time, and that the US fleet in the Indian Ocean, including the Abraham Lincoln and its accompanying destroyers, is simply not a big enough force to track and capture these tankers. Well, it seems to me that if you wanted a force to start capturing tankers, then from the way that Brian Beletic describes it, the kind of Marine force on its helicopter carriers that is being deployed to the region actually might make a kind of sense. It would still be massive overkill. I mean, these are powerful warships that have been used far more than you need to land on and seize a tanker, but they do come with many helicopters. They do come with armed men. It does seem to me that perhaps a more logical explanation for this deployment of the US Marines and their helicopter carriers is to impose finally this blockade on Iran, to stop shipping from Iran, and to stop Iran's continued ability to export oil through the Strait of Hormuz. Now, of course, if that happens, that will intensify the greater, wider energy shortage that we are seeing at the moment. Energy prices again went up this morning, though again they fell back a bit later, perhaps in response to the continued assurances from the administration, from people like Energy Secretary Chris Wright, that the war will not last unduly long. And by the way, there are rumours, which I absolutely cannot confirm, that the United States Treasury is itself now interfering in futures markets in order to try to keep the cost of energy low. There have been various complaints about this from participants in these energy markets. There's a good discussion of this by Eve Smith on Naked Capitalism, and there've also been articles about it in the Financial Times and on Zero Hedge. I'm not going to discuss this because I am not in a position to. I don't know what is going on in these markets, and I don't know what the long-term effect of US Treasury actions in these markets would be. But assuming that the US Treasury is interfering in the markets in the way that is being said, well, that too, or so it seems to me, cannot make up for shortages of energy. And I was reading today in the Financial Times that there are indeed growing problems with energy shortages. In Asia, there's an article in the Financial Times, India's restaurants stop deep frying food as gas crisis bites. South Asia reels from global energy crisis sparked by the US-Israeli war on Iran. In India, crematoriums have stopped using gas to burn their dead, and restaurants have stopped deep frying food. In Pakistan, civil servants are working a 4-day week, and in Bangladesh, universities have shut and exams have been cancelled. The US-Israeli war on Iran has disrupted energy supplies across the globe, but South Asia, which depends heavily on Gulf nations for its gas, has been amongst the most heavily worst affected regions. Indian Prime Minister Modi has told Indians there is no need to panic, but the world's most populous nation is awash with reports of hoarding, theft, and price gouging as citizens rush to secure supplies of increasingly scarce cylinders of liquefied petroleum gas used mainly for cooking. In Pakistan, Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has sought to conserve the country's dwindling supplies of gas from Gulf nations. If the situation continues to deteriorate like this, God forbid those prices will get out of control, Sharif said in an address to the nation. Not very reassuring thing to say, by the way. In Bangladesh, the Prime Minister has already started using half of the lights at his office. He does not turn on air conditioning unless it's urgent. This is being practiced at all offices across the country, said Saleh Shibli, press secretary to recently elected Tariq Rahman. And in fact, Brian Beletic, again in that video that I discussed earlier, has now mentioned that there are also energy shortages starting to take hold in Thailand as well. I cannot imagine that these problems are not going to start a scramble for energy very soon in the international markets, and that this isn't going to put further upward pressure on energy prices, not just in Europe, but even in the United States. And of course, if this whole situation drags on, then the possibility, and I stress it is a possibility, I'm not saying it's definitely going to happen, but the possibility of the United States halting energy exports in order to try to contain energy prices in the United States itself seems to me a real one. It has been done previously in the past. I can remember President Carter doing it in the energy price shock of 1979 to 81. Just saying. So it seems to me it is possible, and you could argue that some of the hints that President Trump is giving in that interview he has just given to the Financial Times, his complaints about NATO, about the NATO countries not taking steps to unblock the Strait of Hormuz, that might point in that very direction. One can imagine the president and his officials, or some of his officials, those of his officials that have pushed for this war, saying to each other, why should we help the Europeans with energy when they have failed to help themselves by taking the necessary steps to unblock the Strait of Hormuz? So bear all that in mind. All of that may be coming, and we could indeed be looking at a major energy price shock this autumn. Anyway, that's what I'm going to say about the situation in and around Iran today. This is, of course, a continuing crisis, but I'm now going to turn to the situation in Ukraine. And the first thing I should say is that there appear to have been significant Russian advances, much more rapid Russian advances now, in the Zaporozhye area. We hear nothing more about the Ukrainian offensive in northern Zaporozhye. It seems that the Russians have now reached a village called Gulyapolske, and that they are in the process of storming other villages, the remaining villages, I should say, between the Russian forces in eastern Zaporozhye region and the town of Orekhov. It seems to me that the battle of Orekhov is probably just weeks away. And elsewhere, there have been further reports of more Russian advances northwest of Pokrovsk. We're all waiting, just to say, for the moment when the Russian Defense Ministry confirms that Grishino, the village to the northwest of Pokrovsk, is under Russian control. I believe that the Russians fully occupy and control Grishino, but that the reason for the delay in announcing the fact is that the village of Grishino is still being heavily targeted by Ukrainian drones, and the Russian Defense Ministry is waiting for that problem to be brought under control before it announces that Grishino is indeed under Russian control and lost to Ukraine. And, well, there are also other reports of the Russians in the process of capturing another big slag heap from the Donbass's coal mining era. This slag heap located to the west of Rodinska, and other positions which tightened the siege of Constantinople, and which also potentially lead to the capture of other places like Dobrupolye and places like that. And in Constantinople itself, it does seem to me, again according to Radiovka, that there's been an acceleration of Russian military activity there too. And I recently discussed the way in which Radiovka is talking about an emerging cauldron in that town. But anyway, putting aside all of these military developments, and by the way, there's been further Russian missile and drone strikes on Ukraine, though the missile strikes seem to have been on a smaller scale, though the drone strike was perhaps a bit bigger than we've seen recently. The Ukrainians, of course, continue their own drone strikes against Russia, which, to repeat, they can only do with American assistance. Anyway, with all of that, I want to focus briefly on the diplomatic, political situation with respect to the conflict in Ukraine. Now, it turns out that Emmanuel Macron did indeed send a delegation of officials to Moscow privately to meet with the Russians and to try to see if there was some sort of way forward. And most remarkably, indeed, I find this little short of extraordinary. In fact, the French apparently said to the Russians, "Well, why aren't you agreeing to negotiate with us?" This appears in an article in the Financial Times. Russia has so far resisted entreaties from European countries to carve out a greater role in the talks. Most recently, last month, when French National Security Advisor Emmanuel Bond and Advisor Bertrand Buchwalter visited Moscow for talks with Yuri Ushakov, Putin's top foreign policy official. The French officials made the case for Moscow to accept that Kiev's European allies should have a seat at the table, according to people familiar with the matter. And then a senior European diplomat tells the Financial Times the Russian response from Ushakov was basically, "Sorry, actually, no, we don't. F you." That's actually in the Financial Times, except where I'm a little bit more prim and I don't want to use the exact word, the F word. It's actually there in the Financial Times. It's written in its entirety. So, according to a European diplomat, the Europeans are now begging the Russians, not just the French. Russia has so far resisted entreaties from European countries to carve out a greater role in the talks. And the Russians, when receiving these entreaties, as happened with these two French emissaries dispatched to Moscow by Macron, the Russians responded by saying, "F off." I have to say, I find this again astonishing. The Europeans, for 4 years, have resisted every effort, every proposal for negotiations. As I discussed in my program yesterday, they were instrumental in sabotaging the April 2022 Istanbul Agreement. Now, when everything is starting to fall apart, they are begging the Russians. The word entreaties is not mine. Again, it comes apparently from a European diplomat talking to the Financial Times. The Russians are rejecting, after 4 years, entreaties that the Europeans are making. Please, please let us join the negotiations. Please listen to us. Please give us a seat at the table. We want to be there when you're talking to the Ukrainians. We want to be there when you are talking to the Americans about Ukraine. We should be there. Please let us come. And the Russians, after 4 years, are, we're told, telling the Europeans, F off. That's not me. To repeat again, that's the Financial Times. Anyway, there we are. That I did find, I must admit, extraordinary. I have no difficulty, by the way, understanding why the Russians are taking this stance. Quite apart from the fact that the Russians don't trust the Europeans an inch, any more than they trust the Ukrainians, any more, by the way, than they trust the Americans. But putting aside the question of trust, which does not exist, why would the Russians agree to give the Europeans a seat at the table when everything suggests that the European demands are exactly the same as always? Europe has a right to have Ukraine join NATO. Ukraine has an unequivocal right to join the EU. There must be no agreement that the Russians have de facto or de jure control over any Ukrainian territory. If they occupy any Ukrainian territory, it is only on a temporary basis as illegal occupiers and no other, that the Russians must in future think about paying Ukraine reparations. Unless and until the Europeans finally accept that nothing of this sort is ever going to happen, unless they start negotiating with the Russians more realistically, looking at the actual situation on the ground, then they will continue, obviously, to receive the same answer from Moscow. And, well, all of this, to my mind, puts the comments that I discussed yesterday by the Belgian Prime Minister, Bart De Wever, in actually a rather more interesting light. Because what Bart De Wever apparently said is this. He actually, and this again, I'm taking from the Financial Times. Bart De Wever has called for the EU to, and this is a direct quote from him, normalize relations with Russia to access cheap energy. A rebuff to the bloc's agreed strategy of maximum support to Ukraine as it seeks to battle Moscow's four-year invasion. And then Bart De Wever is quoted as saying this: we must normalize relations with Russia and regain access to cheap energy. That is common sense. In private, European leaders agree with me, but no one dares to say it out loud. We must end the conflict in the interest of Europe without being naive towards Putin. Of course, there is opposition. Belgium's foreign minister, a member of the very government that De Wever heads, came out and contradicted him, said that he doesn't speak for the entire Belgian government. But one could see the kind of discussion that must be taking place behind the scenes. Back in December, there was this discussion, this angry discussion at the European Council meeting, the one which agreed to pay to Ukraine the 90 billion euro loan, which Ukraine, by the way, has not received. There was a discussion then that some sort of outreach to Moscow needed to take place. There was no agreement, however, on a chief negotiator to speak on behalf of Europe as a whole. It looks as if behind the scenes, further, probably contentious and angry discussions have taken place ever since. Finally, there was an agreement to send these two officials, these two French officials, to Moscow. The initiative obviously came from Macron, but it looks as if they were sent with the backing of other European governments. Spain and Italy, obviously, are likely candidates. Probably there have been others as well. But since there is no agreement in Europe as to the way forward, they came empty-handed and they were basically shown the door almost immediately by Yuri Ushakov. And that, of course, should be no sort of surprise to anyone. Now, there is a narrative that is starting to appear, at least in the British media. I haven't yet seen it in the American media, and I'm not sure whether it is appearing in the European media, though I suspect it will before very long. This is that the balance of the war was starting to shift again in Ukraine's favour, that the Ukrainians were starting to gain the advantage on the battlefields, that oil prices were creating problems for the Russians, and that all of this has now been jeopardized by that foolish, reckless man in the White House, Donald Trump, who has reversed Ukraine's forthcoming victory by starting a war against Iran, which has deprived Ukraine of the weapons it needs and has given the Russians the injection of funds they're going to get from increased oil sales. Now, to say it straightforwardly, that whole narrative is nonsense. It is completely absurd. Just a few weeks ago, Pokrovsk and Mirnograd fell, Gulyapolye fell, the Russians have been continuing to advance in Zaporozhye region and in all sorts of other places. There were deficits appearing in the Russian budget. These were, in my opinion, mostly caused by the high interest rates, as I discussed in my program yesterday. A budget deficit is not the same as a fiscal crisis. And as Wolfgang Munchau has written in an excellent article in Unheard, and as my friend Ian Proud repeatedly points out, the entire narrative that Russia is about to run out of money is absurd. Well, however, this narrative is out there, and what it shows is that despite the refusal to make any substantive concessions to the Russians whatsoever, which caused the failure of the talks in Moscow between the French and the Russians, the Europeans and the Ukrainians understand that the war, finally understand that the war is being lost, as Bart De Wever also said, without the Americans, what can the Europeans do? And again, I quote his words, given that we are unable to pressure Putin by sending weapons to Ukraine and cannot suffocate his economy without US support, only one method remains: make a deal. It is incredible that it has taken 4 years for a European leader, until very recently in good standing with the European leadership, finally to arrive at that conclusion and to say this openly. And various people, Viktor Orban, our friend, Jeffrey Sachs, I say our friend because he has so often and so generously agreed to do programs with us on the Duran, he has also said that European leaders in private tell different stories, that there is a community, a group of European leaders who have told Jeffrey Sachs, as apparently they've also told Viktor Orban, that, you know, we go along with this strategy of maximum pressure on Russia and of maximum support for Ukraine, but we don't really believe in it. Anyway, it seems to me that if Bart De Wever is prepared to break out, is prepared to put that omerta to one side, the moment has come for all of those European leaders to put their cowardice behind them and to come out and say it openly. Ukraine is losing, will lose, Russia has won, Europe has been hammered by its decision to cut itself off from Russian energy. The cost is deindustrialization and economic crisis. The only way forward that makes sense is normalization with Moscow, and that means agreeing a deal over Ukraine, which must be on Russian terms. Perhaps, just possibly, we are closer to this point in Europe than we have been up to now. It may be, now that these discussions finally in Europe are taking place, that rational thinking will finally break through. But at what price, at what cost, it makes one weep to think it. Well, all I would say is about these cowardly leaders who refuse to say in public what it is, what they think in private. These cowardly leaders might care to look at what is happening to two of Europe's sometime hardliners. There's just been regional elections in France. The story of these regional elections is of continued big gains by Le Pen's by Le Pen's party and by Jean-Luc Mélenchon's left-wing group. Both are rapidly establishing themselves as the two big competing electoral groups, blocs in France. Macron's party appears to be in terminal collapse. The socialists and the Républicains, the historic traditional centre-left and centre-right parties in France, are also clearly under pressure, even though taking advantage of incumbency in some places, they've been able to cling on. But the one thing that unites both Le Pen's group and Mélenchon's group is disagreement with the policy about Ukraine, the EU-Europe policy on Ukraine, the agreement of both of these blocs that the policy must change and that some kind of normalization of relations with Russia must now happen. And it is likely that in Britain we are going to see the same in the May elections, the May local elections, which are coming. I discussed yesterday that Zach Polanski of the Greens is now also talking finally about normalization of relations with Russia, or at least of some kind of outreach to the Russians. And of course, the same is true, to some extent at least, of Reform. Both the Greens and Reform are holding far back from what the French left and the French right are both saying, but they're starting to take tentative steps in that direction. And again, all the opinion polls suggest that it will be these parties, not the establishment parties, Keir Starmer's Labour Party and the Conservative Party, which remain wedded to Project Ukraine. It is these two parties that have opposed it that are the ones that are going to score big in the local elections in May. For their own interests, these parties, these leaders of Europe, who have advocated endless war against Russia, need to rethink their strategy. You would like to think that they would do so, but I very much fear that a combination of fanaticism and fear will, of course, keep us firmly on the current course. And of course, if they do decide to change the course, if they do start to seek normalization with Russian, with the Russians, they have the other enormous problem of explaining the change to the Ukrainians and to the person that they have made, at least in Europe, that great superstar, Vladimir Zelensky. Anyway, this is where I am going to end this program today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.